Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
What I love about breakfast and find quite fascinating about it is the way that people talk about it in moralistic terms. You should and you shouldn't eat it in certain ways or have certain things for it or eat it at certain times.
Or whether you should even eat breakfast at all. Author Abigail Carroll walks us through what the first meal of the day looked like back in colonial days and why we all started eating cold breakfast cereal. Chef Daniel Orr has a hot breakfast cereal for us, jam-packed with nuts and fruits and lots of seasonings. Why farmers are skeptical about a vaccine for cows. Harvest Public Media also talks about why China is such an important market for Midwest farmers. And we meet a community of kids who get by just fine despite their food allergies. News. First up, Luann Johnson is at the mic.
Yes, and ice cream lovers, take note. Bluebell is now asking consumers and retailers to throw away all of its products. It's part of a voluntary recall over concerns of listeria. The CDC has discovered 8 illnesses, 5 in Kansas and 3 in Texas, over the span of 4 years, starting in 2011. The ice cream maker has said it will implement a preemptive testing system where products will only be made available to retailers after they've been deemed safe for consumers. Kraft announced this week that it will be removing artificial preservatives and colors from its most iconic box of food, mac and cheese. Pressure for the change came from food blogger Vani Hari, better known as the Food Babe. Her petition gathered 350,000 signatures over 2 years. The Washington Post published a profile of this controversial food blogger. We've posted the link to that article on Twitter, at Earth Eats. Bird flu on Midwestern poultry farms is spreading. The USDA has confirmed that avian influenza has been found in 13 turkey flocks in Minnesota. 3 counties in Wisconsin have also reported illnesses in poultry, and in Iowa, it's infested a flock of 3.8 million egg-laying hens. The CDC says the risk to humans from bird flu is low. And an update from Vermont this week as the state formally adopted rules for labeling foods that contain GMOs. Food writer Marion Nessel picked out 3 of the rules that seemed especially important. Unpackaged GMO foods must post labels. If the food is GMO, it cannot be labeled natural. And the font can't be any smaller than that of serving size in the nutrition facts label. Vermont passed the labeling law last year, becoming the first state to do so. The Grocery Manufacturers Association and other trade groups sued the state, claiming the law is unconstitutional. Pending the outcome of that lawsuit, the labeling rules could go into effect on July 1st, 2016.
All right, all of those links have been included in the latest post at eartheats.org. Find them there and then share with your social networks. Glad to get our weekly updates from Luann Johnson. Thanks.
Anytime.
Thousands of people get sick every year from E. coli bacteria in their food. The beef industry has gone to great lengths to limit illnesses in meat. But as Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach reports, there's one way to keep people from getting sick that the industry has been slow to adopt.
Burger night at our house, so I'm headed out to put a few patties on the grill. I'm going to make sure these are well cooked because ground beef has a track record of causing some serious outbreaks of food illness, like E. coli 0157H7. The problem is when cows carry E. coli bacteria in their gut, it's totally harmless, but if 0157 gets on your meat and then you undercook it, you could easily end up in the hospital. Meat companies have been trying to clean up their E. coli problem. Infections are down 30% from the late 90s. Still, most E. coli outbreaks are from beef, and I've got 2 little kids, so better safe than sorry. But what if you didn't have to worry so much? What if there was an E. coli vaccine that could reduce your risk of getting sick? Actually, there is, but it's not for people. It's a vaccine for cows.
Steer. 29, Brad.
A load of calves just arrived at a University of Nebraska-Lincoln research feedlot. Like any cattle coming to a new home, they're being checked over by research technician Kurt Bittner.
If it's a heifer, we tag it in the left ear. In a steer, we tag it in the right ear.
And then we vaccinate them like we are today for respiratory disease.
But are they getting an E. coli vaccine?
No, we are not getting an E. coli vaccine.
I'm not aware of anybody who's currently giving the vaccine. My guess, it would be close to zero.
That's feedlot researcher Galen Erickson. There are actually two vaccines. One sold in the U.S. by Zoetis has been around about 5 years. Erickson helped study a Canadian vaccine from a company called BioNiche. Both reduced the amount of E. coli passed through cattle manure.
For sure, the vaccine that we worked with, that was BioNiche's vaccine, is very effective with a 60% reduction. That's certainly conclusive that it works.
But neither vaccine has had many takers. Erickson says feedlots want to cut E. coli, and they would use a vaccine if they could afford it. E. coli vaccines cost between $8 and $15 a cow. Doesn't sound like a lot, but Ted Schroeder, an agricultural economist at Kansas State, says over time that could swallow up their profit.
Anytime you add even what look like small costs per head, it very quickly takes a sizable chunk out of their profitability.
Feeders won't pay for a vaccine unless they make more money for cattle that carry less E. coli. So far, the big packers won't pay that premium. They already sterilize cattle hides to kill any bacteria. They test meat before it leaves the plant. And Schroeder says adding a vaccine on top of that isn't worth it, unless there are proven cost savings down the line, like fewer meat recalls.
The challenge is, I don't know that anyone knows right now how much of a probability reduction you can get in those recall events and or their size and or their magnitude by just vaccinating. But it's on all their radar screens.
It's not just a concern for meat packers, though. E. coli from cattle can also cross-contaminate fruits and vegetables grown near pastures and feedlots.
E. coli has become, you know, in a sense, a ubiquitous pathogen.
That's Seattle food safety attorney Bill Marler. He's sued some of the country's biggest food makers and retailers. Marler gives food companies credit for fewer E. coli illnesses. But when it comes to the vaccine, he says they're dragging their feet.
I don't think we're going to see vaccines happening, you know, unless there's some kind of outbreak crisis or litigation crisis that sort of drives the decision making.
Marler plans to add some legal pressure. He has a case right now against Whole Foods and a grass-fed beef ranch in Missouri. Hamburger from the ranch sickened several people and killed an 8-year-old boy in Massachusetts.
One of the questions that we're going to be asking in this lawsuit is, did you ever consider, you know, vaccinating your cows with, you know, with this vaccine?
Maybe they couldn't afford it. But depending on how the lawsuit turns out, companies from grocery stores on down to feedlots may start to think about whether they can afford not to. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
Coming up, how China influences American farms. The food Abigail Carroll eats for breakfast is a little unorthodox. On the day I chatted with her, she had ground grass-fed beef with tomato puree and sautéed Swiss chard and onions, leftovers from dinner the night before.
Which is very colonial of me, I must admit.
And she should know, she wrote the book Three Squares, The Invention of the American Meal. It talks about how eating in America has evolved with the invention of cereals and on-the-go snacking and the idealized family dinner. The cover depicts the many dishes of breakfast. Eggs and bacon, a bowl of cereal, toast, coffee. She says breakfast holds a unique place in the discourse about the American meal structure.
What I love about breakfast and find quite fascinating about it is the way that people talk about it in moralistic terms. You should and you shouldn't eat it in certain ways or have certain things for it or eat it at certain times, you know, or just the fact that you should eat it. I mean, there's that whole debate of whether you even should eat breakfast. And you don't see that around the other meals as you do around breakfast.
But it wasn't always that way. In the 16 and 1700s, breakfast foods as we know them today just didn't exist.
People were eating, like I had for my breakfast, they were eating leftovers for breakfast, or they might have cornmeal mush, they might have bread and cheese or bread and butter, a slice of pie.
Fast forward to the mid-1800s, Americans were suffering from a collective bout of indigestion. Food reformers started to promote a new idea of breakfast. Eat less, eat lighter.
And they were all about health food. And their number one health food was what they called Graham flour, which was flour that still had the bran in it because it was starting to be processed out of flour and therefore of bread. And so this sort of panacea for all digestive problems becomes the star of the new breakfast. And so that's kind of when the debate starts. You know, that's when people started to talk about breakfast in terms of shoulds and shouldn'ts.
Graham flour was invented by Sylvester Graham, who also preached vegetarianism. John Harvey Kellogg, of course, helped bring cold breakfast cereals onto American tables. Between those two inventors was Henry Crowell, the founder of Quaker Oats.
You know, Quaker Oats was the first packaged breakfast food before breakfast cereals. And oats, of course, are a lot like breakfast cereal. They're just a different way to do cereal. They're eaten hot rather than cold. But they also sort of fit into the new breakfast ideal of the mid to late 19th century because it was, you know, light. But hot cereal goes back a long ways. You know, you see people stirring grains in pots with water, you know, in Britain, and it's very much a peasant food. And if they didn't have, you know, barley to do that with or oats, you know, they would do it with beans or peas. And you have your peas porridge, which is just a different version of that. And people didn't think of it as a breakfast food. They might have eaten it in the morning. They might have eaten it in the evening for supper. It could be a snack. It was a hasty pudding, which meant that it didn't take terribly long to make. Of course, it took less time to make breakfast cereal, you know, cold breakfast cereal. And so that was one of the advantages that breakfast cereal had over oats.
In addition to being the first packaged breakfast food, Quaker Oats had a reputation for purity, thanks in part to the logo featuring the Quaker Man. And purity was important to consumers at the turn of the 20th century.
Food was being sold in bulk for the most part. So if you were going to buy oats, you would go to the store or you could go to your grocer or, you know, you would buy the grains and many other ingredients out of barrels. And there was exposure to air, dust, contaminants, germs, smells, all sorts of things. And not to mention the food could be sitting there for a long time. Well, with packaging, that changed. Packaging ensured that it arrived to the consumer pretty much untouched, especially if it was manufactured by machinery. And so there was a purity associated with that, and people were very interested in purity.
Carol says there are a number of reasons why breakfast evolved from heavy and meat-centered to light and grain-centered. Consumers wanted purity in their food. She talked about the health and nutrition concerns. Of course, there's always taste to take into account. But all these factors, she says, get trumped by work.
Because if they were going to eat a farmer's breakfast and then head to work and sit at a desk, they were not necessarily going to be very productive and efficient. And so the lighter breakfast is an example of a new emphasis on efficiency. And we see that at lunch too. And that's one of the reasons dinner shifts to the evening, because you can't, you know, have that main hot meal of the day in the middle of the day and then go back and sit at your desk for the rest of the day. It just doesn't work out as well. And so in an era of making factories efficient and conveyor belts and streamlining production processes, there's a kind of streamlining of the American diet that takes place. And it's just one more example of how closely the shape of the meal is tied in with the shape of culture and specifically our work culture.
She says we've been debating the ins and outs of our first meal of the day for hundreds of years, and how we eat breakfast today is just the latest chapter in that ongoing debate. Her book is Three Squares, The Invention of the American Meal. Talking about oats there with Abigail Carroll. Coming up, Chef Daniel Orr has a recipe that's relevant to our interests.
And the great thing about this recipe is you do it the night before. You just do this, you leave it on the stove overnight, and your steel-cut oats will be perfect in the morning.
Perfect for your get-up-and-go morning routine. Can't wait to show you all the goodies the chef puts into these oats. Stay with us. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations. Bloomingfoods.coop. Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Annie Corrigan here for Earth Eats. Hello. Alexis Daly has food allergies. When she was young, she felt isolated because she didn't have a support group of kids her age who were also dealing with food allergies. She recently spoke with several young kids today who are able to look on the bright side of their struggles, in part because they have each other.
Growing up with a food allergy isn't easy.
Sunflower seeds, evaporated cane syrup, milled cane sugar, salt.
We read every label and carry an EpiPen and Benadryl wherever we go. But there are 50% more children with allergies now than when I was little, during the late 90s. When I was their age, I didn't know anyone else.
Yeah, when I get home from work, the first thing I have to do is get a Clorox wipe and wipe down my phone.
Wendy Taylor is a mother of four kids with food allergies. You heard one of them, Miranda, reading a label at the top of this piece. Wendy says this makes seemingly simple tasks much more involved, especially since three of her children are in the growing population of people with multiple airborne allergies. As we drive to their house, she explains what it's like for her family to go grocery shopping.
So we grab a cart, we wipe down the cart, and then wipe down our hands, and then we do our grocery shopping, and then read every label every time. You know, things change. And then put it all in the car, and then get it home, and wipe it all down again.
Reactions vary, but usually include hives and trouble breathing, which can be deadly. This is Miranda again.
I read every label, even if it comes in the house, I read every label that I eat.
Next to their food pantry is a whiteboard with a chart of each family member's name and a list of allergens. It's 1 foot long and wide and reminds me of an extremely intense bingo playing card. When each kid said their allergies,
peanuts,
egg, peanut, rye,
I'm allergic to egg.
Brussels sprouts,
parsley, paprika,
nuts,
tree nuts,
egg, peanut, rye.
I couldn't help but feel grateful that I only had an allergy to nuts. It seemed like such a big hassle when I was little, but it's nothing compared to this.
Did I say peanuts?
But the Taylor kids, their views kind of surprised me. They aren't really scared. This is Audrey.
I watched the movie Soul Surfer, and I take my allergies as a learning opportunity and an opportunity to help other people. So, and to give them advice, like a friend just came to the allergy table with new allergies. So, yeah, I kind of wonder what it would be like, the opportunities that I would have. But, I mean, my family takes care of me, and we do things our own way. I mean, it's kind of fun.
They have separate allergy-friendly tables at schools, as well as support groups for the parents. This is the Hitchcock family. They're in the same support group with the Taylors. Like the Taylor kids, Zach and Abby understand allergies are serious, but having done this their whole lives gives them confidence. This is 8-year-old Abby.
You have to be careful with them. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of hard for kids with food allergies, so.
Why is it hard?
Because you have to be making sure that everything you eat is safe and that you won't get an allergic reaction, because it isn't fun.
Her brother Zach, a fifth grader who's allergic to dairy, eggs, soy, and all types of nuts, has a different take.
Having a food allergy also sort of brings me special talents, like being able to sing really well, play guitar, and dance to Michael Jackson. I can do the moonwalk, just saying.
I have to admit, I'm a little jealous. And I think what I've learned from this is that community can significantly transform an otherwise frustrating and scary situation into, for Audrey, a chance to help people Or, for Zach, special talents like a super cool dance move. For Earth Eats, I'm Alexis Daly.
We work with students like Alexis from Indiana University's Media School. Thanks to Sarah Neal Estes for help with this and with other student stories. Hear more of these young journalists at eartheats.org. It's planting time for Midwest farmers, and much of the corn they're starting now will end up feeding livestock in China, which has become a huge importer of grain from the Corn Belt. But China has its own rules for the kind of crops it wants, and when American farmers don't comply, that market dries up. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer explains the outsized role China can play on American farms.
This is a story about corn and China and regulatory approval. But wait, don't roll your eyes. We can explain this with kids on a playground. Picture a school. Students in blue, green, and occasionally red shirts gather in different classrooms. Then, at dismissal time, all the children clamor to get out the door. But what if kids wearing red shirts get turned away at the door? Red shirts are allowed at school, but they're not allowed on the playground. In fact, entire classes are sent back to their rooms if even one child is wearing red. How does that relate to corn? Each kid represents one farmer's harvest. All the corn gets mixed together at the local grain elevator, like kids in a classroom. Then, the mixed together harvests are shipped off to China, the playground.
China has returned 12 shipments of genetically modified U.S. corn.
But not all American-grown corn is welcome in China. As Chinese state television reported, in 2013, China found a genetically engineered trait in U.S. corn. It was approved here, but had not yet been approved there.
Which violates China's rules on GM products. 545,000 tons of...
It's that handful of kids who got caught in red shirts keeping their classes off the playground.
When you hear China has banned all U.S. corn, a person in my position, that's not good.
That's Ward Graham, a farmer in South Central Iowa. He says when China closed its market, farmers like him missed out on a payday. Graham blames Syngenta, the company that put the new kind of genetically engineered seeds on the market in the U.S.
The decisions they make don't just affect them. They affect everyone. They affect all the farmers.
Graham and hundreds of other farmers from throughout corn country are suing Syngenta, holding the company accountable for lost profits. A class action could eventually make almost any farmer who grows corn eligible for a settlement.
I think what's taking place now is a bad situation being turned into a terrible mess by what I call the tractor-chasing troll lawyers.
Tim Burak farms in northeast Iowa. He's received a half dozen invitations to meet with lawyers. But he cautions farmers not to be short-sighted. They could lose a lot more down the road if the Chinese continue to be slow to approve new traits and willing to reject all U.S. corn. Seed companies might stop investing in innovation.
Why would a company bring forth a product if it isn't approved in China with the threat of being sued here at home?
Syngenta is also asking that question, says Dwayne Martin, who works on commercial traits at the company.
We certainly want to sound the alarm that this is a potential threat to continued innovation for U.S. growers, whether it's in corn or any other major crop.
Syngenta denies any wrongdoing, but lawyers are continuing to prepare the farmers' lawsuits. Most in the U.S. agree that the real solution is a coordinated approval process for new seed technology. U.S. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack says those talks are ongoing.
We are in the process, obviously, of continuing to work with a number of our foreign customers to create a regulatory system and process that's more aligned and more synchronized.
Meanwhile, China has approved the seeds that caused the recent trouble. So at least for now, all the children, even those in red shirts, can hit the swings. Oh, yeah. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
more stories about food and agriculture from this reporter collective at harvestpublicmedia.org. We learned about the history of Quaker oats with Abby Carroll in the first part of the show. Daniel Orr goes to the next level with this warm breakfast cereal.
This is steel-cut oats, and they take a lot longer to cook. And a lot of times it will stick to the bottom of the pan. You know, you're there in the morning, and it takes 45 minutes to cook, so you don't have time. So I'm going to show you an easy way. What we do here is I have got a pan on. I'm going to put a little bit of oil in the pan, and then add about half a cup of oats, depending on how many people you're cooking for. And what we're going to do is just toast those a little bit. Well, what this does is it brings out kind of a nutty, smoky flavor. And you want them just to get a little bit brown and start to smoke a little bit. And they'll taste much more kind of nutty and smoky. Okay, so we let these toast. We're going to cover them with about an inch of water. All right, we're going to bring that back to the fire, bring that up to a boil. While we're waiting for that to boil, we're going to add some orange zest. And that's going to bring a little more intrigue and mystery to your oats. And once it boils, I'm going to add just a little bit of vanilla. Now, you want it to boil first, because if you add this right now, a lot of the flavor will just go up into the air. So we're going to bring that to a boil. And the great thing about this recipe is you do it the night before. You just do this, you leave it on the stove overnight, and your steel-cut oats will be perfect in the morning. All right, so we've come to a full boil here. Going to add just about a teaspoon of vanilla, give it a good stir, bring it back to a rolling boil, and then just turn off the heat. And that's all there is to cooking breakfast. All right, so I've got some that I've already done the night before. And what I like about these steel-cut oats is they kind of have this little crunch and pop in your mouth, whereas the rolled oats just kind of taste like wallpaper paste. You know, so I really like these. So to finish this off, I'm going to put just a little bit of brown sugar, and then I've toasted some pecans. When you toast them, what that does is it brings out some of the moisture and intensifies the flavor of the nut and gives them a little extra crunch. You can put just a little more orange zest on top just so you can see that. And you don't need a lot of sugar and stuff when you have those extra flavors of the vanilla and the orange peel in there. They kind of make it an automatically appealing breakfast.
Plenty of other breakfast ideas from the chef. Chia seed pudding. What about a green smoothie? Or if you're going to go all out, he's got a recipe for baked eggs, sausage, potatoes, tomatoes, peppers, cheese. It is amazing, also huge. Give your appetite and your creativity a boost at eartheats.org. Always working hard for Earth Eats are Ayabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Sarah Neil Estes, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepherd, and the reporters at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations. Bloomingfoods.coop. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. We love having you join us. Come back again same time next week. I'm Annie Corrigan.